places that we can autonomously create, but we also need to find a way of defending and challenging those. So I wonder if you have any ideas around that.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Let's get three and then. Yeah, who's taking the put on this?
In your proposal, when you talked about the creation of a social base and linking up different autonomous forms of reproduction, last year I went to various autonomous zones through Europe into the Middle East asking the question, how do we connect up with each other? And we didn't get very many great answers. It's a very difficult question. And often what people would say is, it's easy in your local area. So you mentioned a community garden, you can lend a spade to a friend or something. But how do we connect up these autonomous spaces through nation states or, you know, from here to France or to Greece, especially in this time of austerity?
And then John up the back, I think, had a hand up.
Hi, I had a question about your definition, your critique of the welfare state as it being kind of a deliberate project of investment in the working class to make them more productive. And I have been operating under the assumption that, at least in France where I'm from, the welfare state had been kind of constructed by victories of especially the Communist Party and the constitution that was written right after the war because communists had been able to. So for me, it's a result of struggle. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you're implying that it happened with the ascent of the ruling class instead of being taken away from them.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you want to respond?
Yeah, I think I'll respond. Yeah, I'm glad. All these are great questions, and they're really crucial. I first of all, when I speak of building these autonomous forms of reproduction, right, I do not speak in the sense that we now have to abandon other struggles and we have to concentrate only on that. Right? That, for example, wage struggles are not important and or struggle, for example, about not allowing the state to dismantle what is the public, whatever is being left, for example, the welfare state. I want to come to that question later. But what I think I'm trying to say is that more and more is becoming very difficult to win any of the struggles without at the same time to having a kind of a social base from which we can begin to connect the struggle in particular workplaces and also the struggle in the community. And in fact, this is something that really goes deep into the history of working class struggle. Because every time, for instance, you know, struggle in any workplace, think of the miners in Harlan County, or have reached a certain point of intensity, has reached a certain point of our confrontation, then immediately the whole community had to come together. Immediately there had to be the people who came together with the food when the money ran out, and you were had to confront the miners' company, etc., etc. And people had to begin to pool resources. And people had to begin to do for each other things that they would not have done. They have turned to the market to have done, right? What I'm saying is that example of situation that we have known, you know, all over and over developing in times of emergency, in times of intense struggle, tell us something about what we need to do as a precondition to be able to even confront the state. The context in which also this has to be placed, you know, this context now of 3 or 4 decades of neoliberal disaggregation of our life, disaggregation of our social fabric, of our social context, whether it is, you know, in the classic workplace where you have precarity and you have flexibilization and you have relocation. And so the community, for example, the kind of communal organization that people have built, you know, over many, many years, and they were a power. I mean, for example, in the United States, the industrial Northeast was an incredible power. I mean, people had, you know, a power that came not only from what they had organized in the factory, but they came a power because of the communities that they had organized. People met at the bar, people knew, and they knew, they had relationship with each other, that they knew who had your back. They knew who was going to stand with you when the cops came, or who would go away. They knew they had a kind of relationship of trust, of bonding, for which you were willing to risk each other's lives. We don't have that now. We don't have that now. We have gone through so much gentrification in the urban areas, you know, where basically community had been torn apart. Yeah, destruction of the organization of work, where again you are working with people that hardly you probably know of. So there is that need. I think the issue of the commons is not only a what's the word? Anticipation of the society to come, a kind of a cell, right? A micro form of the kind of society that we want to build. But the idea of the common is also the idea of constructing a social base, constructing as a sort of a precondition for reuniting so many different parts of our community and life that have been disrupted and made us and disarmed us. I think that this is what, so ideally, for example, if you have a community and if you have the time banks, and if you have the garden with the food, etc., the struggle in the firehouse will have much more power. And the people will not be only dependent on the power they can develop on the basis of their organization, but their power will be amplified by the fact that there will be also other... And here I want to connect with your question. There was another one, and I'll come to it, about the welfare state, right? Everything must be read politically, obviously. And so also when we speak of welfare state, we also have to, in each case, look at the histories of how those political forms developed, right? And I would agree with you, right? In fact, this has been a kind of a common consensus, and that the welfare state was the product of a long struggle. The workers had won certain benefits and so on, right? I think in more recent time, probably around in concomitance with this discussion of building commons, you know, that people have begun to go back and look at, you know, remember, in the 20s, in around World War I, before the New Deal in the United States, before the 30s, before when the welfare state took a real form, actually unions used to do that, right? The unions provided pension, compensation when you had an accident, they put out the money when there was a funeral, they had the houses in which people congregated, which people came together at the end of the workday, you went to, and you know, and in a way, there is now an argument that some have developed that in a way the New Deal, right, was a form of disempowerment. That there was a power in those communities, right? Now, I'll be the last to say that now we have to say no to whatever state investment in reproduction is there. That would be irresponsible. And, as we're struggling for commons, we also have to defend whatever is there public that is not being completely privatized. So, absolutely. At the same time, We also cannot allow to have only the state. We also have to begin the process, you know, of building the type of cooperation in the production of our own daily reproduction and the production of our life. Because the state gives and take. And the question is, what is the power that we have? What the state, what is there, depends very much from the power that we have. And we see now that, you know, we have communities that are there only in name. That the kind of cooperation that used to exist. In fact, the reason why, you know, public investment in reproduction has come to an end is because they have been able to actually, through industrial relocation, through the restructuring of the global economy, they have been able to put us in the defensive. So they can say, they can make all these cuts because our own social power has been undermined. So that's it. There was another question, and I don't remember who, where it came from. Yes. Yeah, the international. Yeah, Rex. Yeah. All I can say is that, of course, it's all to be built. But we have seen some example of how that coordination can begin to work in recent months, last year in New York and in the United States around the Occupy movement. For example, some of the coordination that took place between New York and Oakland, California, around the building of the struggle around the port, for instance, when, you know, some of the resources to organize the strike in Oakland of the port, which is a very, very important port. Many of the goods coming into the United States from Asia come into the Oakland harbor. And the Occupy movement in California was able to shut it down twice, right? Which is quite a feat. And there was a process of collaboration there that actually put people in touch from New York to California to provide some resources for that. This is like a very, very small example, but I would agree. This is something into which we have to put our energies to build.
Thanks, it's been really fascinating. My first question has actually just been answered. So I've got another question, which is, when you're talking about the microcredit bit, you're talking about groups that do have that collectivity and haven't had that already destroyed. They do have a kind of sense of a common and a sense of kind of collective solidarity. But then you're saying that actually turns against the individual in a sense. And I think my question is, what's your analysis as to why we don't see more examples of collective non-payment in those situations? Why can't the common in those cases, is it just the actual, you know, something about the poverty level or something about, you know, because you're saying here, you know, the fact that, I don't quite get the connection, because you're saying here, it's the individualization of the debt which is actualizing.
Exactly.
We face ourselves as an individual to the bank, so
that
we're saying there,
it's
the opposite. But the other thing I also want to say is in the last, two or three weeks, I've suddenly found myself in £3,000 worth of debt to the Child Tax Credit and to Hackney Council through adamant errors of me not telling about change of circumstances and change of address and things, and I've in fact had to bail it. And it's been really nice being able to politicise that rather than feeling that it's my own administrative errors of I was supposed to fill this form in on this day and didn't, and I'm now debt to pay it off, you know, £5 a month or whatever, but for the next.
Down here there was one, and then I'll go up to you. Sorry, should have been the other way.
I was interested in this notion of the new form of class relation that you describe, and. And my question is, which is the working class today? I'm a bit lost.
Mm.
I know what precarity is. I know very well what precarity is. And I wonder if precarity gives ways to another class, himself. So, because of course, when you talk about destruction of building commons, I think the issue here is to have a kind of form of consciousness. Who I share with? Who are the other as well?
Mm-hmm. And then up the back to the gentleman on the steps.
Hi, I think it was very nice making the point about how even the notion of community itself becomes absorbed through this new condition that capitalism is creating with debt, and how, you know, through debt it becomes maintained, but obviously it's a different form of community, but how it goes. But then I think your examples were only, we have to do with, you know, the very beginnings of the formation of a community itself, either whether you would go on the Western or being a student, you would just enter that point, or whether you would go in the other developer, whatever, you know, world and say that people would keep on. But how do you go, like, in the West, in the highly developed world, when, let's say, there is a form of silence of us today, when, I mean, the sole female worker has managed all this simply to find out today that more and more technology will be invading even, you know, the process of carrying out, of giving birth, that more and more and more, this will be even financialized, and, you know, and as a person, it has to remain silent on that. Thank you.
I'm not sure about this question. Maybe, can you rephrase it a little bit, the last part? This last part, can you rephrase it a
well,
little bit?
Well, the last phrase was that increasingly in the Western world,
yeah,
you know, it's, you know, we saw suffrage coming, you know, being realized in a sense in terms of equality. What we're seeing today is that the sole female being dragged more and more, you know, into her origin in a sense, you know, that, you know, like, you can, technology is entering the very process of what the female is.
Mm-hmm.
And on that question, there is a silence, obviously, because the movement is gone on the name of equality. That's what all
oh,
I wanted to ask.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'll start with this question. I mean, certainly the issue, boy, it's a big, big question, because yeah, clearly the struggle for equality, right, and has been a real, you know, demonstration of how equality is not a form of emancipation, and you can see it in so many ways. And to me, one outstanding example that says it all is the idea of women having achieved equality in the army. So that now women have been able to also kill people, kill other women and children like themselves. And this is the equality that we have reached. And so this is a very banker, you know, equality. And I never believed in equality because I never believed that men were free. And consequently, to be equal to other types of slaves is not emancipation. You know? So we can have so that, and I'm definitely very appalled by the way now women are giving birth, right? And that now you are completely industrialized. In the United States, you got to 2 hours, okay? It's an assembly line, and you have 2 hours, and you do it in 2 hours, or you don't do it, and then they cut you out. And, you know, and you give birth all booked up, and depending on the season of the year, how fast the doctors want to go to vacation, you know, you have an increase or a decrease in cesarean cuts. And yeah, that's obviously not what we want. So this is not the kind of technology that we're looking for liberation. And another question, there were other two questions, and maybe you can...
Precarity and formation of class.
Yes, but there was a...
Ziggy's question.
Okay, right, yes. The whole idea of precarity is... Well, and the question of the work, you know, there's been now this whole experimentation with names, right, about replacing working class. And, you know, I'm more in favor of finding new names because obviously the reality has changed. But I don't think that so much the reality has changed in terms of the fact that there's a population of people who are being exploited in so many different ways, the ways continuously change. But I think that what's most important in terms of thinking of struggle, you know, is the fact that we cannot have struggles that are only concentrated or limited to the so-called workplace. I say so-called because obviously it's a very the traditional trade union and even Marxist view of what constitutes the workplace is extremely restrictive, right? So we need to think of struggles, in fact, that involve all the different aspects of our life. So that when we think of a struggle now, we cannot separate what is happening in certain jobs from what is happening, for example, to the food that we eat, and what is happening, for example, to the way the fields in which the food that we eat is being cultivated, or what is happening, for example, with the nuclear plants near which we live. So that in a way, the struggles that we have to make are struggles that really cover many, many, many different fronts. And those have to be connected. Because otherwise it's self-defeating. Otherwise we have, struggles that, basically reproduce the very conditions that we are fighting against. And this to me is a very, very fundamental. But there was a question that was raised and I wanted to reply and I cannot remember. In fact, the question that you raised is so important, because you can really look, particularly looking at, many, many parts of what some call the third world, and others are very, very upset because it has a kind of degrading terminology to call it third world. And so I usually use the former colonial world, or I don't like north and south either. Right? We really have to invent not only different words for working class, but also different words for describing, the political economy of different regions. But there is a kind of contrast of two pictures that emerge when we look at the struggles that people have developed against structural adjustment, for instance, in response to the neoliberal onslaught on the economies, in Africa, Latin America. So, for example, one response has been really to create many communal forms of existence, many very communal forms of life. The Zapatistas, for example, have organized, land occupations. There is squatters movements that have grown all over Latin America. Think of the MST, for instance. That have really squatted and taken over and created communities in many parts in Brazil and so on. And the MST is not alone. There are incredible struggles that are going on of fishermen community, fishermen and fisherwomen villages, right, to prevent the devastation of the coastline, to fight against aquaculture, to fight against the fact that their villages are being taken over and transformed into these big tanks for shrimps, so that we can have these jumbo shrimps in cocktails. Don't eat shrimps, by the way. So they're also poisonous. actually of any policy, as you know that too, you know, they better to not score. But it's pure policy. So there's been an incredible amount of commoning, right? There's been an incredible amount of commoning. Women in different parts of Latin America, Chile, Mexico, Bolivia, have created collective forms of reproduction. You know, the famous collective cooking pots, or Ola Comunes, right? So these are also the groups that they are trying to target, to disrupt those forms of commonality, and you know, which represent a power, represent an incredible power. You know, for example, again, the movements of women that Vandana Shiva and others speak about in India, fighting against the dams, right? Fighting against the logging of forests, because the forests represent a great common where you can take a lot of things, medical, plants, roots, fruits, leaves. And this is exactly the kind of activities that now, you know, the World Bank and the many, many NGOs are really targeting also to the policy. In fact, the World Bank has made its own the philosophy and the economics thinking of Hernández Soto, the Peruvian economist Hernández Soto, that basically is selling this idea that the what we call the nature commons, the wealth commons, the land, for instance, these are not productive. These are not fertile. And I'm not inventing it. I know it seems crazy, but actually what he says, what is productive and alive is money. The money is really what produces prosperity. And Hernández Soto for years has, you know, disseminated this creed that the reason why there is poverty in the world is because so many people still are using land and are using forest as a means of sustenance. Whereas what they should do, if they have some land, they should take this land to the bank. And taking it to the bank, they should get, as a collateral, to get some credit, which is exactly the story of microfinance. If you have a little bank, get your credit, and then you lift yourself, you set up a little business, because this is economic life. This is what reproduces ourselves. I think we have to fight that mentality. I need to fight the mentality that says, if you only had that $500, you would be able to actually lift yourself out of poverty. Obviously, for many people, when you have, you know, the woman with the telephone, because they have hired an army, mostly of women, or, you know, with a little cell phone, who go from village to sell the microcredit, to say, you get this money, you get this loan, great. You know, you're going 5 months, and you'll be so much better, right? It's very enticing, you know, for people who are always on the edge. But the record now shows, in fact, that this has been a trap. That, in fact, the women have taken the money, by and large, in fact, much, much worse off after a few years from taking the loan than they were before. And that actually is in stark contrast, you know, to other forms of pooling resources. For example, in many, many parts of Africa and Asia, there is an institution, a very old institution, which has been the model for microcredit, you know, the tontine. The famous tontine is when women come together and you put together whatever little money every month, and then whenever you need it, you take that money. And there is no interest, there is no bank, there's no World Bank, there's no NGO. It's something that is called, you know, it's a pooling of resources. You know, in the same ways as part of Latin America, you know, people help each other to build houses, right? They take you, the AILU system, etc., etc., are all forms of common, of creative ways of of reciprocity, the relationship of reciprocity, right, that are very fundamental for people in production, that have allowed many communities to survive, even through many phases of colonization, and to survive in a way that is not completely disintegrated there. Which is explained, for example, why in a place like Bolivia, you could have one of the most incredible victories and battles that we know in recent times. For example, the water wars of 2000, where you have all these communities in El Alto and in Cochabamba coming together, and indigenous communities, and putting an end to the attempt to privatize their water, and actually forcing one of the most outstanding, feat, which was reversing the privatization of their water. And I think right there, in similar struggle, you develop a certain principle, which for me has become a kind of guideline, which is that the struggle is strongest, not where capitalist development is the highest, but where the community is most cohesive. You know, that this is where, in a sense, power decides. And that's why we are in such a bad shape. But I think also the movement that we are seeing in recent times, for example, the Occupy movement in the United States, for all its limits, which are many, and I don't want to idealize it, but we have also to, in a sense, give space and give support to what is beginning to show some life. Has also given us the hope that maybe something is also developing, that there is the desire for kind of movements that not only contest power, protest, and challenge, but also are interested in creating new forms of bonding and creating new forms of reproduction that intensify, you know, social cooperation.
Sorry, John, you're coming down. I'll take one, two, three, four. Take four and
yeah.
Okay. Susan Kelly.
Yeah. Hi, I'm I suppose it's an advice question, really, just coming back to the kind of concrete situation we're sitting in right here. Something that's really struck me this year, it's the first year that we've got students coming in who will leave with £50,000 plus debt. As a teacher in the institution, no matter how involved you are in the struggles around education, most Wednesdays I still go and do open days. I feel like I'm selling debt, like you're bringing back a person to the villages, yeah? Where I'm saying, and the better I talk about what I do here as a teacher, the more likely I am to sell the debt. And so I'm stuck in this insane contradiction that's completely in your stomach, and no matter how much activism I do around the struggles, I'm still, I'm a reproducer of debt in this situation. And I guess, I'm wondering, how do we deal with such intense contradictions when we're at this complete moment of financialization?
Can I respond?
Yeah.
I sympathize. I'm a teacher too. You know, actually I'm retired, but I sympathize. And by the last years of my teaching, I was feeling so uncomfortable because you are in such a contradiction. In a way, I know, and the good thing, for example, for the Strike Debt movement is that that movement also makes a space for the teachers, and I think it's very important because teacher has to be part of the struggle. We don't want to produce the indentured servants, right? And we should be part of the same struggle, and which is a struggle which is even broader than the debt. It's a struggle against the university becoming a business. It's a struggle against the commercialization of agriculture, of agricultural culture, as agriculture. It's going to continue. It's a struggle against you know, using the production of knowledge to create hierarchies in society and to deepen those hierarchies. And so there are many, many battle fronts, you know, in a university. For example, who is a producer of knowledge? Why only certain subjects, you know, in academic environment are considered to be producers of knowledge? And we need to really also address those hierarchy. And the same thing also, the grading system is a selective system. Who's going to sweep the street and who's going to, you know, man the computers? And but the issue of the debt is very pivotal, because students don't have any time any longer, even to do politics on campus. Because many students I had, they have three jobs, because they are trying to get out of university as fast as possible, because they see their debt growing. Right? So even to be able to be a teacher, even to be able to discuss, et cetera, you have to have students who have time, who are not strangled by the prospect of coming out of university with a huge load of loans on their shoulders. And so this is why I think a number of teachers have also been involved in the United States. And so, for example, the movement that there is in New York has worked out this strategy. There is a petition, and the petition says, I refuse to pay this debt, and I will not pay when there's going to be another 1 million students like me who will not pay. Right? So it's nicely articulated, because it kind of protects you and it kind of gives you an incentive to get these other people with you to fight, right? But there are three petitions, because one is also on the side of the teachers. And the teachers' petition basically says that we don't want to be involved, you know, in producing students who are, in fact, enslaved to the banks. This is not our job. So that when I sell these great ideas, in reality, I also sell students. So I think that that's in one situation in which it's that the struggle has to be a common struggle. I think, yeah. Because in fact, the same phenomena that are enslaving the students are also enslaving the teachers. And I mean, I cannot, those that I mentioned is only the beginning. If you have to start saying all the different ways in which our life as teachers have been degraded, you know, not that the university was ever a pure area, you know, not touched by economic and capitalist relations, but what has happened, you know, in recent time is such a level of degradation that, you know, we really have to confront it. Because, you know, otherwise we become pure direct servants of the banks and the corporations, not to mention the military. Yeah.
We've nearly been going for 2 hours, and I know it's going to disappoint some people who had questions to ask, but I think it's probably time to wrap up, given the long trek home from the deep dark south of New Cross that many of us have to make. And also because Sylvia's been speaking for nearly 2 hours, which I think is a superhuman effort. I'd like everyone to put their hands together for a thanks. And I think that before many of us make that journey, either around the corner or across the river or east or west, we'll probably go to the New Cross House, which is what we always do, because that's part of the tradition of Goldsmiths somehow, to have a wee beverage before we make our migration. And everyone is welcome to join us.
We thank Camille for organising this.
Sorry, I've been a bit remiss.
Sorry, there's one last announcement, which is just a bit hilarious thing that I would forget. That Sylvia's book is on sale here this evening and is for £10. So if you would like to pick up a copy of Revolution at Point Zero, you should come and speak with Daniel and he'll be able to sort you out.